It's always been strange to me that people try to use the Bible to define and support what our country has come to call traditional family values. As if there is some clear support for a two-spouse nuclear family plainly outlined in the Bible. Just going to give you some spoilers. Hardly anything in the Bible matches that idea of a family. And instead, as Mihi Kim Court, a Presbyterian minister and theologian, states, in the Bible, we find Jacob with his many wives, concubines, 12 sons, and one daughter. Solomon with his hundreds of wives and children. Hannah abandoning her son Samuel to the temple and forgoing any further influence on his life. The Gospels' portrayal of the disciples, apostles, and Jesus with no mention of their family lives, and the New Testament's letters' emphasis on celibacy. None of that sounds like a two-parent nuclear family to me. And if that weren't enough, one of the most common scripture readings that is used at weddings is from the book of Ruth. I'm sure you've probably heard it before. Wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. It's beautiful. But very few people realize that this was a conversation happening between two women. And to be honest, any attempt to create a biblical picture of marriage and family as a traditional, it's piecemeal. It's pick and choosing verses and then stringing them together. Kim Court instead describes a much more coherent biblical image of a family. She says, a family is being a space that teaches the full value of humanity. It's the beautifully chaotic space of creating. It's messily becoming through a love that multiplies itself by leaps and bounds with grace, always present at the door. Her definition allows a family to be biological or not, one parent or two parents or more. Any makeup of genders, perhaps grandparents or friends, or in the case of my daughter Ren's aunties, people who love and care for her and want what's best for her and promise God to do those things at her baptism. Case in point is today's gospel. We come on this scene. It's right after Jesus has named his 12 disciples, those men whom Mark says were to be with him and to be sent out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. They're all in a house trying to eat dinner, but the house is so crowded by everyone wanting to get to Jesus that they can't get close enough to the table. Now, Jesus' family had heard of his healings and his teachings and the general discord he had been sowing throughout the region, how he had gone around questioning authority and eating with tax collectors and sinners and keeping company with sexually dubious persons. They can come up with only one explanation for his behavior: that he has gone crazy. Or in other words, he has an unclean spirit. And so they're coming to confront him. They came and crashed the party, if it were. But he doesn't know that. Jesus can't see them. Jesus doesn't even know they're there. There's just too many people. But then at the same time, some scribes who are experts in scripture arrived and took the accusation one step further. They said that not only is Jesus insane and filled with unclean spirits, but that he is actually possessed by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons. take a step back for a second. Does this behavior sound familiar at all? Trying to cast doubt on someone you disagree with? Painting a picture of them as somehow misguided or perverting justice? Perhaps demonizing them or questioning their mental capacity? It's a common technique. And throughout history, it has been effectively weaponized. Think about the period of the Salem witch trials, where accusing someone of cavorting with Satan or being a witch could get you killed. Or during World War II Germany, where being discovered as Jewish meant a death sentence. Or even during the Red Scare, where one could accuse an enemy of being a communist and they would disappear for good. It was, and it is, a convenient way to get rid of one's enemies. The scribes and Jesus' family think that Jesus has a disordered love of humanity. He is willing to risk too much for these outcasts and deviants and these people at the margins, and they have decided that he must be stopped. And had they won, had they been able to stop him then and there, we would never be talking about him. But when Jesus is told that his mother and sisters and brothers are there looking for him, he rejects them. And he says, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking at those around him, he said, "Here. Here are my mother and brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." Now, it seems harsh, especially as a parent. This seems really harsh. But Jesus is laying out something loud and clear here. He is making his boundaries known. In the new world order that he is establishing, doing the will of God is the mark of his family. He is creating a chosen family, one that establishes and advances the idea that the full dignity, value, and love that God has for humanity applies to all people. He draws the line in the sand. You are either with him on that and in his chosen family, or you are out. Because, to use Jesus' words, if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. We all have to be on the same page, understanding that God's family is very truly messily becoming through a love that multiplies itself, leaps and bounds with grace, always present at the door. My friends, this is the kind of family that gives life to all people. This is the kind of family that the church is called to embrace and to embody. This is the kind of family that cares for all, that loves all, and works to uphold the dignity of all. This is the kind of family that echoes the will of God. Do you want to be a part of this chosen family? You have already been chosen. The invitation has been extended. Jesus is ready and waiting to make you his beloved siblings. But we must be willing and ready to work for the will of God and bring about that divine empire. What will you do?